Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here. Mike Cosentino sitting
here. Yes, we're doing our radio voice this morning. Mike Cosentino here, and we have a special guest.
Yeah, we have a special guest, Bill Timmerman. First, we're going to try to make our announcements before we start the program. And
there is no asteroid heading toward the Earth.
I know many of you folks think we're socialists and Marxists, and next week we actually have a real live...
That's right.
I don't know what kind of Marxist he is, but we have an actual Marxist named Eric
Marxist,
Olin Wright.
Zeppo Marxist.
And he's an analytical Marxist, whatever that is.
Karl Marx, just the unfunniest of the Marx brothers.
Well, Eric Wright has a... program or a YouTube thing where it's called "If Marx is Wrong, Why Are We Still Studying Him?" It's a good thing. Anyway, he's a distinguished professor at the University of Wisconsin. Been around a long time. He's written a really widely discussed book in academic circles called "Envisioning Real Utopias." And I thought we should do in this year talk about some broader stuff. Are we really, is what we see now literally it? So next week, Eric Olin Wright. The week after, we have a Russian expert, John Patrick Willerton, and he's going to be talking about Putin's Russia, what's happening in Russia today. And I think if you folks follow the news and stuff, you'll see there's a lot of stuff going on in Russia. Pat Willerton is a really independent thinker about Russia. He's fluent in Russia. He goes over there all the time. He talks to people. So he's going to be 2 weeks from today. 2 weeks from today. And we had some other announcements. The Door movie this week is about Moluccan folks. Tell us a little bit about Moluccans, Bill.
Well, these are a very similar situation to the Hmong who were left over after the Vietnam War. They were Dutch allies and sort of their native colonial policemen for the Dutch Empire in Indonesia. And after Indonesian independence, it was feared that the Indonesian government would attack them and
they weren't the most popular guys.
No, so there was a lot of pressure to return them to Holland, but the Dutch didn't want to take them back. But the UN and the Indonesian government sort of put pressure on them, and so these Moluccans, who had spoke Dutch, were Dutch Reformed Christians, and who thought of themselves as Black Dutch, they called themselves. They wound up in Holland, and they weren't treated very well. And this is their story.
And it's being shown movie night, the Door movie night, on Wednesday, April 10th at 6 p.m. It's free. It's at the Sedona Public Library. So that it looks like a really good film. The filmmakers will be there to discuss these issues. One of them is Moluccan, a Dutch Moluccan woman. And the story is in part about her family. So that's the film April 10th. April 18th, we have Patrick Willerton talking about Putin's Russia today. We'll find out what's going on there from a source beyond the kind of news. It should be exciting, interesting program. That's the Door breakfast on April 18th. The doors open at 8 o'clock. The program begins about 8:30. So today, what are we talking about, Bill?
Today, we're going to take a look at U.S. defense spending and United States foreign policy in light of our military posture. And the question we're going to ask basically is: are we getting what we we've paid for.
These figures are incredible, the amount of money we spent, but you're going to get to it.
So Bill's title is U.S. Defense Spending. Are we getting what we paid for? What are we getting for our buck? But I think you mean in a broader sense, not just are we getting dollar and dollar return. Are there wasted money on aircraft that we don't need and so forth? You're talking about something else.
Yeah, I'm talking about the way our foreign policy since World War II has increasingly become dominated by a military perspective. We tend to view the world as a place that we need to police. You know, in other words, we consider ourselves responsible for the world order. And this dates back really to 1945, to right after the end of World War II, when, if you looked around at the world, the United States was kind of the last man standing. We were the only advanced industrial economy that was undamaged. We were the only political system that had survived, except for the one in the Soviet Union, which, of course, is directly opposed to our view of the world. But at any rate, the United States, and probably rightly so, thought of itself as responsible for getting the world back on its feet. And by all accounts, we were enormously successful. We completely restored the economies of China and Japan. We brought them back into the world as our allies and as economic powerhouses. And we stripped them completely of their military ambitions. The other thing we managed to do was to block the attempts of the Soviet Union and the Chinese to extend communist influence into the industrial world, which was they considered in their interest to do. We fashioned a containment policy that was only in part military, that basically, you know, restricted them to the spheres of influence that they had gained by their victories in World War II.
It's interesting that the Japanese or Germans ended up hating us, even though we occupied their country. How did that come about? Was it the way we treated them?
It was principally political and economic. For one thing, we went fairly gently with our purge of ex-Nazis. We didn't treat everybody as though they had been a Nazi. And the Marshall Plan provided a tremendous amount of economic aid. And similar things happened in Japan under MacArthur. We gave their economic entrepreneurs pretty much a free hand in the country, as long as they were willing to give up their military ambitions.
So one thing you said, as far as a cost-benefit analysis goes, which then it seemed good looking back, good cost-benefit. Now we want to do, is it still worth it? Is there still a cost?
Well,
there's,
I think the
analysis?
Other thing to point out is that everything Bill's talking about was extremely controversial. The Marshall Plan was extremely controversial.
Yeah.
Some people wanted to have a war with the Soviet Union. My God, some people, some of the conservatives wanted to bomb communist China, which was actually sort of communist.
Well, that's true. That's true. This the idea that diplomacy trumped military affairs. was part of our post-war policy. But there was a hidden dark side to this, and that is that because of Pearl Harbor and because the Soviet Union after 1949 had nuclear weapons, the traditional American idea of disbanding your army after the war went away. And we maintain very large military forces, naval, air force, particularly the air force. Just remember the Strategic Air Command and intercontinental nuclear bombers and later missiles.
Now, so after 1945, and last week we talked with an expert on the Constitution, there was a huge battle about whether to even have a standing army. Now, so that is that when the United States finally built up a huge standing army?
Yes, yes. There was, the demobilization that occurred in 1946 and 1947 reduced the sizes of our forces tremendously. So we let all the soldiers go back home. They'd pretty much had enough after spending, you know, 4 years in Europe or Japan. But we maintained our technological superiority, and we decided to make up in terms of the capability of our weapons with the fact that we had much smaller armies than our potential enemies, the China and the Soviet Union. And so what happened was that this idea that we had to always be ready because we couldn't wait until the threat was upon us, because we did have intercontinental weapons of mass destruction. We had been attacked without warning at Pearl Harbor, and it kind of set everybody's teeth on edge. So we decided that, unlike the America of the past, I mean, America in 1936 or 37, before the Roosevelt buildup started, had an army with 130,000 people in it. By the time the war was over, there were 3 million people in the army. But if you've got nuclear weapons that are 30 minutes away, you can't wait that long to have. So what happened was we invested hugely, particularly in the technological aspects of our military, in the Air Force and in the Navy particularly. And then, of course, we had the Korean War, which tended to kind of confirm this idea that we had to have a military that stretched all over the world. But today, you know, it's 68 years later, and the situation is very different in the world, but our attitudes toward it haven't changed. I mean, the United States is...
So we're still disturbed. I think Americans get very disturbed by the idea that the feeling that we're losing our influence to some extent. And what's all that's happening is that other countries are rising to their natural rate.
Well, that's it. I mean, today, what's different about 1945 is that our military is still dominant. And our economy is still the single largest economy in the world. But we no longer control the world economy. In fact, we can't control it. I mean, our gross domestic product's about $17 million. China's is about half that, but China has already passed Japan as the number two economy in the world.
Japan's number three.
The European community as a whole has a slightly larger GDP than the United States, but that, of course, is not a single
country.
So,
if we don't have as much influence in the economies of the world, are we falling back on this military spending as a substitute for that?
If you look at what I'm about to tell you about the statistics, about what we're paying for our military, I think the conclusion you have to draw is that we've drawn the wrong lessons from World War II. They were the right lessons at the time, but in a changed world, it's no longer, the United States really can't continue thinking of itself as the world's policeman. It's just not appropriate anymore. And the other thing is that the impact on other things, on our what they call our soft power, on our economic success, our education, our infrastructure within the country, the impact on that is almost all of it actually negative, because we're focused on this idea that we have to be the strongest country in the world, and that has a limited lifespan. We're nearing the end of the ability to put our money where our mouth is.
And there seem to be artificial goals. We have to fight 2 land wars at one time. Why don't you give us the statistics on, American military spending? How does it compare with these other countries?
Well, the long and the short of it is America spends 41% of the total amount of money spent on the militaries in the world.
Maybe we should repeat that.
41% of the money spent on military preparedness and military equipment and armies, navies, and air forces in the world is spent by the United States. We spend, our nominal budget for the military budget is $711 billion a year. That's 4.7% of our GDP. That's about $2,100 per person. 300 million people times $2,100, and you get $711 billion. China, on the other hand, spends $143 billion, which is what? It's only about a fifth of our budget, only 2% of their GDP, and only 8.2% of the world budget. And the second largest spender on military equipment.
We should probably explain that the GDP is shorthand for the whole domestic production of the country. So when Bill says that it's 4.7% of the GDP, we're talking about the military spending represents that part of our whole economy.
Yeah, the gross domestic product is basically everything of value produced within the borders of the country in a year. And the world total, by the way, is $1,738,000,000,000, which is 2.5% of world GDP and about $1,500 a person. So you can see we're spending almost half of the amount spent on military. Now that takes a tremendous toll, even on the world's largest economy. I also have to add that this $711 billion is only the basic Defense Department budget that's authorized by Congress. It doesn't include funding for nuclear weapons, veteran affairs, homeland security, or interest on the debt for past wars. If you include that spending, the total is somewhere between $1 trillion and $1.4 trillion. And the reason there's so much slop in those figures is that a lot of the Defense Department budget is scattered around and hidden and black programs and so forth. And it's really hard to get a handle on all. And then also interest costs on our loans varies.
And
so
the difference between the CIA and the military seems to be fading, right? They're both doing it. But one of the things we have is a lot of military bases. What's the story on military bases?
Because well, if you
think of the big ones, but I'm not sure we think of the whole.
Well, you know, when I say that that American diplomacy has been replaced by the American military, this is the sort of thing I mean. You know, we used to have an embassy in every country, and you know, in larger countries, we'd have a few consulates. But depending on whose numbers you're taking, and it's really hard to nail down these numbers because the Defense Department doesn't appear to even know how many foreign bases we have. But the total number looks like it's over 1,000 bases outside the continental United States. And that includes everything from huge naval facilities like the ones on Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean or Yokosuka, Japan, which a lot of people who've been in the Navy are familiar with Yokosuka, because it was our biggest Asian base. And that goes all the way back down to, you know, little battalion-sized forward observation bases in Afghanistan. But the total number seems to be about 1,000. And within the United States, domestically, we have almost 5,000 bases listed by the Pentagon. So and when you think about it, that's an awful lot of real estate around the world controlled not by our diplomatic corps, but by our military. And in many cases, these bases are unknown to and unapproved by the countries in which those bases are operating. So, you know.
So the United States, we just sort of drifted into this in a way.
After World War II, there was nobody else around to put things back together except us. We were the only ones that had the wherewithal to do it.
So we just kind of started building bases and we didn't stop. And there's always reason for a new base, and there's always you have a forward base. You have, even if you have 10 guys there, if it's enough that you can land another 1,000
guys.
Well,
and then there's force protection. You know, you start with a small base and then you're afraid it can be attacked. So then you fortify it more, and then you bring in more people, and then you add other bases to protect its perimeter. Next thing you know, I mean, but when you're reasoning like the military, when you're in threat assessment mode, every disagreement with the United States looks like a threat to the United States. You don't ever talk to people, you defend against them. It's a really different mindset, and in many instances, it's inappropriate. So that's part of the cost is just generated by this idea that we have to have the resources available, that wherever there's a conflict, we can dominate and control it. You know, full spectrum dominance is the Pentagon phrase.
Yeah. You have ministers on TV right now saying, Barack, pick up the phone, call Kim Il-sung, you know, the president or the leader of North Korea, and say, what's the beef? You know, and we could dial back a lot of this stuff, but it's okay. all through
so
diplomacy.
Part of this big, huge cost is, you know, in addition to readiness, training the troops and so forth, is to maintain these foreign military bases so that we don't have to come all the way from the United States to stop something that we don't like. We're already there. And one of the other things is, you know, we don't have a draft anymore, and we don't have, compared to, say, World War II, we don't have a large standing military in terms of personnel. We rely a lot on high-tech weaponry, and we rely a lot on staying ahead of the competition. Of course, there's not much competition right now, thanks to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but we're worried, our military planners are worried about China in the future. So, you know, to some extent this makes sense. See, we have to overcome a manpower disadvantage. The problem is that as technology improves, that, you know, our intercontinental missiles, our nuclear submarines, our 11 nuclear aircraft carrier strike groups, they're all without equal now and in the foreseeable future, but the cost's enormous. The other thing is that this reliance on high-tech weaponry can result, even without corruption in defense expenditures, it can result in A, increased development times, B, substandard performance and reliability because these weapons become so complex that testing them, you know, leaves bugs in their software. And then you can also wind up with weapons which are ill-suited to defend against threats which have changed since the development process began. Let me give you a couple of examples. Everybody's heard of the F-22. It's our new air superiority fighter. It entered service in 2005. Well, you know, we only built 187 of them, and 8 of them have crashed. And they cost about $150 million initial cost. They're projected to cost $678 million apiece over their total projected lifetime. That's maintenance and upgrades and operational costs. This plane has never flown a single combat sortie. And it has an oxygen system that tends to suffocate pilots, and they haven't yet been able to figure out exactly what's caused the problem. Then you take the F-35. That's the plane that was supposed to be cheaper than the F-22. We're going to build a lot of them like we built the F-16. It was only supposed to cost $23 billion, and we were going to make one for the Marines and one for the Air Force, one for the Navy, and we were going to have 80% parts in common, and everything was going to work out just fine. Well, it's not projected to enter service now, the Air Force version, until 2018. We're going to procure 2,443 of these things at an initial cost, we thought, of $23 billion. That cost is now projected to be $135 million apiece. And the total cost over the lifetime for each plane is $618 million. That's half $1 billion, folks.
This is the cheaper
fighter. Cheaper fighter. And meanwhile, it has poor aerodynamic performance, weight, thermal and lightning protection, pilot visibility, and stealth capability than the design specifications originally called for. And after a decade of development, the high-tech helmet that was supposed to allow the pilot to aim the weapons by looking at things, they still can't get that to work, and they've been working on it for 10 years. This is an example of what can happen to you. There's these huge cost overruns. I mean, you know, if you're talking $618 million a plane, and you're going to build 2,500 planes, right?
Do we need them? Do we have an?
That's the other thing. I mean, you know, it looks like we're going to wind up using drones, you know, which are a lot cheaper, and we don't have. There's no aerial threat envelope. You know, I mean, the Russians basically don't have an advanced air force anymore, and the Chinese are probably years away from developing one. So there's no threat that these planes are.
So we're building more and more advanced fighters against to dominate airspace that we can dominate.
And by the time they're out of development, the threat no longer exists.
Plane.
That's exactly my point. And the other thing that happens here, to give you an idea of how much our military now dominates our foreign policy, Here's some figures about the State Department. The State Department, the budget for the State Department in 2010 was $51.7 billion. And the actual expenditure was $21.4 billion. Now, compare this to the $711 billion we spend on the military. That's approximately 3% of the Defense Department budget and 2% of the Defense Department's actual expenditures. And if that's a valid indicator of the importance of traditional diplomacy, it's pretty clear that military considerations take precedence. Another interesting fact, as of 2009, the State Department had a total of 22,000 employees, a total worldwide, 22,000 employees. That's slightly more than enough people that it would take to crew three of our 11 aircraft carriers.
That's great.
So it's, I mean, Homeland Security has 240,000 people, and the State Department has 22,000. It has some foreign employees, too, right?
Yeah. So this is what we're paying for, okay? And it's a huge amount of money, folks. 4% of $17 trillion is a lot of money. It's 4% of our GDP is spent on the military. It's been higher in the past. It was higher during World War II. It was higher during the, as a percentage of GDP during the Reagan buildup. But it's still plenty high. I mean, think what you could do with $711 billion for infrastructure, education, you know, even traditional diplomacy, you know, foreign aid, right?
It's harder to sell foreign aid. It's hard to explain diplomacy. It's hard to explain, well, how diplomacy works as a an adjunct to and a substitute and sometimes for military force.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, you know,
when there's a lot of fear built up.
It's, well, that's what we're spending, you know. Now let's ask ourselves what we're getting for it, okay? And why don't we start with something that the military thinks it's good at, the wars, right? Looked at objectively. Let's go back to the Vietnam War. It killed 58,000 Americans. And we wound up with a Vietnam that was unified under the very government that we'd gone to war against. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have killed, you know, 6,000 people in Iraq. We've killed 100,000 Iraqis. We've sent 6 million of the 32 million people, would displace them. We set off a bloody sectarian war, and we left them behind a majority Shiite government that's allied with Iran. In Afghanistan, the Taliban now controls the south. The north is controlled by warlords whose allegiances are unknown. The only thing that the U.S.-supported government controls is the city of Kabul. So we've spent $711 billion a year, and even our wars don't look like they have achieved the cost what we set out to. I mean, look at the Middle East, right? I mean, we support all of these dictators. We send billions of dollars to the Israelis, and what do we wind up with? And
the scariest result, and I've seen this in other sources besides your materials, is that nations are convinced that the only way to keep the U.S. out is to become a nuclear power. Bush's invasion of Iraq taught the world that if you don't want the U.S. in, then you better get nuclear weapons right now.
I think what
If you want to control nuclear proliferation, threatening people with invasion is probably not the way to go.
I think what Bill is saying is that, and I think that Mike and I really agree with him, it's time to look realistically at the United States military budget, what we're doing, what is that called? The backlash,
yeah.
The backlash we get from establishing military bases where they're really not wanted. I mean, if you look at Afghanistan, they seem to sort of hate us, and we spend all this money. So I think Bill is just appealing to folks to look realistically at what is going on.
Yeah, I mean the point is the military model, the control and policing of the world model, has it not become in the long run counterproductive? Don't we have to get along better with people? It's something to think about.
And anyone from a 10-year-old school child to a senior citizen can think of lots and lots of other places where the money would be certainly better used. Or
all of the statistics and other information that Bill's talked about today and examining American armed forces, our needs, the role and stuff, will be available in a couple of days on our website, Gary LeMaster is really good at culling through all the information and putting it up. We'll hope you take a look at all the details, folks, and join us next week.
VVID.org is the address. VVID.org.
That's all, folks.
Is our address.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.